There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
And welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel. I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is at the controls. And on today's program, the Democratic National Convention, free speech, and protest. Today we'll be speaking to Adam Davis and to Sarah Lazare, who are two local reporters from the Independent Media Center, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, that is, who were at the DNC and the protests this past week. Adam's in the studio with us, and Sarah's in the phone. We'll be talking to them to find out what really was going on in the streets that we did not see in the mainstream media. And we'll also catch up with some news of our media environment. Do stay tuned. And so this was the big media week for the Democrats out there in Boston, where they had the Democratic National Convention. But it was not such a great week in many ways for free speech, because the place for protests was a pen made up by chain link fence and razor wire. With me in the studio here is Adam Davis. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming by. And we should have Sarah Lazare on the phone.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, there we go. The both of you were out there this last week, and you got to see a bit of what was going on around the protests and, of course, around the convention. Maybe we'll start with you, Sarah. Can you describe for us a little bit, did you get to see the so-called free speech zone, which was more like a pen?
Yeah, I saw the very edge of it. We marched to the edge of the protest pit. So I saw the fence area, and I saw all the people standing around it and all of the, you know, scary sniper-looking military people standing on bridges and rooftops ready to go.
And were there a lot of protesters inside the pen?
It was sort of hard to tell. There were definitely a few.
And did either of you spend any time inside there doing any protest activity?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Did you spend any time in the pen doing protest activity?
It was sort of hard to tell where the pen ended, but I was definitely aware of being cornered up against the fence. And it appeared that I was at least somewhat inside of the pen, so yes, I did.
Okay. Now, I watched some of the coverage on mainstream television, a little bit on C-SPAN, and listened to some on NPR and on Pacifica. And I didn't hear very much report at all about protesters. And what reporting there was actually sort of very dismissive. In fact, they would talk about maybe the one lone protester with a megaphone and usually characterize that person as sort of fringe or sort of crazy. So, Adam, I mean, what did you see?
Well, this mobilization was a lot different than any other that I'd been to because it was made up of different autonomous actions that individual affinity groups were doing that were coming from across the country. So what may have seemed as individuals or small groups of people doing actions was actually different groups working together doing different actions around the city, addressing different issues that were important to them.
So, for instance, what were some of the actions, some of the groups?
For instance, there were a lot of banner drops that were done around the city. I didn't see this, but I read that there was an action at a Gap addressing the corporate nature of the Democratic Party and Republican Party.
And a banner drop is when people sort of get into a building, right?
Or outside of a building or a bridge and drop a banner with a message for people to see. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Sarah, did you participate in any particular marches or actions?
There were a lot of different actions. The Democracy Bazaar, the day before the Day of Action, which was the 28th, I consider an action. Anarchists and other anti-authoritarians took over Boston Commons and had performances and workshops and groups and skill sharing information and scenes available to everyone. And that was a really awesome day of action, minus the helicopters circling above and the strong police presence. I thought that was really successful. And then the next day, there was a really, really rad critical mass bike ride. It was so much fun. We got to see the entire city. Energy was really high. People were cheering and chanting and hollering and did a great job of keeping spirits high despite the strong police presence. And then there was an actual march that we all participated in, and there were really awesome different autonomous actions that happened within that march. For example, there was a pirate block that showed up about halfway through the march. All of a sudden, you know, across the way, we see all these pirates coming, and
people dressed as pirates?
Yeah, they were dressed as pirates, and they had made cardboard boats, and they had hats and patches and parrots and everything. And when we united with them, there was the biggest adrenaline rush ever. It was great.
About how many people do you think were involved in that march altogether?
I'm really bad at estimating.
I think it was about 500 to 600 people.
Okay.
I was going to say, like, maybe 700 or 800.
I'll take your word for it, then.
Yeah.
And maybe you could describe, maybe not everyone knows what a critical mass is.
Okay. Did you want me to describe that, or?
Sure.
Basically, a critical mass bike ride is when tons of people on bicycles take to the streets, and tactics may vary from place to place, but the tactics at this critical mass bike ride was to block traffic as a way of protesting the ways cars overrun a place and the way that's connected to environmental pollution, as well as the dirty politics of oil and the uglification of a place.
And did you both go on this ride?
Yes.
Okay. And so about how many people, Adam, do you think were there on this critical mass ride?
150, 200 people.
All on bicycles?
All on bicycles.
And what was the police response?
The police followed us the entire way, and sometimes they led the way also to supposedly stop traffic. At one point, there was an altercation, and a cop attacked a protester, and apparently his bike was broken in some way. But the critical mass went on, and we continued around the city.
Okay. So it kind of, the picture that at least I'm getting in my head listening to you, it seems like there were a lot of medium-sized sort of actions, maybe 100 to several hundred people going on, and there was a lot of police presence, which I guess has its own effect on the protesters. Would you say so?
For sure. I mean, it's never a good feeling to have cops right behind you, knowing that they've got all this power behind them. They've got billy clubs. They've got they've got their gas masks ready just in case they use chemical weapons on us. So it's never a great feeling. But it's something, unfortunately, that happens at almost every protest.
But a lot of these things were probably not permitted, were they? I mean, the critical mass was not a permitted march or anything.
No.
So it sounds as though the police tactics were a little different than maybe what was seen in Miami, which was a very, very aggressive use of force. I mean, you can correct me, because I'm only going off what you're telling me and what little I've read in the press.
Yeah, well, their tactics were similar in that they were ready to do the same things they did in Miami. Fortunately, it didn't get nearly as bad. And actually, Sarah was in Miami, so maybe she can speak more to this.
Yeah, I think that one of the major differences between this protest in Miami and the one in Miami is that Miami was much more sort of march-focused. Mm-hmm. So, and because there were more numbers at the March in Miami than the March in Boston, things just escalated a lot quickly. People were more concentrated. There were greater numbers. And because of those greater numbers, people in Miami were probably a bit more civilly disobedient. But in Boston, because it was decentralized and more affinity group focused, it was harder to infiltrate and harder to concentrate all that force because it was spread out. And also, just to add to what Adam was saying earlier about the way having that police presence affects a protest, I think one really salient thing to me is that, you know, like having that fear and that just that very like blatant oppressive force right there in front of you just reminds you that this is really real stuff that we're dealing with and that we're fighting for. It really brings it home in a very personal way.
Now, did you have any contact with convention goers, anyone who was actually in the convention?
Especially on our critical mass ride, we talked to a lot of people who, you know, didn't know why we were riding down the street and blocking traffic, and so we had a lot of conversations with them. Also, in the action, the bazaar that we had in Boston Commons, it was free for anybody to come in and you know, get information. So there was a lot of interaction between protesters and potential protesters and delegations to the DNC.
Did it seem like that there was conflict? Did it seem like delegates or convention goers were somewhat open to what a lot of the protesters and say the folks at the bazaar had to say?
At times, it seemed like, you know, we would have civil conversations, and at other times I saw people screaming at each other just because we don't see eye to eye on certain things, on a lot of things.
Yeah, I wanted to ask something. Did you guys run into any opposition from a lot of people that would normally say we would be out here protesting Bush's policies and maybe Republican Party policies, but, you know, you being out here protesting a Democratic National Convention, that's a slap in the face to a progressive movement that you claim to be a part of. I mean, what was the response that you had to any of that? Did you get people that were, you know, that were really feeling like you shouldn't be out there because this is the chance to beat Bush, right? I mean, that's the line.
I mean, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Adam.
No, go ahead, Sarah.
I didn't experience a lot of that directly at the actual protest, but just sort of talking about this with different family members and just with different people I know, I have definitely gotten that sort of reaction. You know, just the basic, like, Bush is a lunatic. It's really dangerous to risk him getting reelected. But as far as that being at the actual protest, I didn't experience so much of that.
I think also we expected a lot more people, and one of the reasons that we came up with that we thought people didn't show up to the protest was because a lot of people have this mentality right now. It's, you know, just get Bush out of there.
Anybody but Bush.
Exactly. And so, you know, that might have been a response to, you know, mm-hmm. that thought pattern.
I see.
So.
Okay.
Did you have a chance to either see the Convergence area? I think maybe the Boston Independent Media Center had something. Did you get a chance to interact with any other independent journalists?
Oh yeah, they were awesome. There weren't very many people running it, but the people that were running it were really, the people that were like facilitating, were really, really on it. I was actually able to get a lot of footage, with a video camera, and, it was really easy to just get plugged in and to get those images up on Indy Media right away.
Oh, okay. And, so is some of that stuff on the Boston Independent Media Center website?
Yeah. Actually, a lot of that is stuff that I recorded.
Great. That's boston.indymedia.org. And you, Adam, did you have a chance to...
No, Sarah held the camera the whole time.
Okay.
She rocked.
But did you have a chance to also meet some of the Independent Media Center folks?
Not so much. You could definitely tell the difference between the corporate media and the independent media, especially like when it came when the cops were getting really rough with protesters. A lot of the big corporate media were really being aggressive and pushing people aside, which is
they were being aggressive towards protesters.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Really?
A corporate journalist pushed me into a line of police.
Now, was this someone with a camera, you know, with a big shoulder mount of camera? Or was this just someone with a notepad or what?
A huge camera.
I see.
A gigantic camera, and he pushed me into a police officer.
So you did get to see the corporate media. Did you get to talk to them at all, or?
I certainly didn't talk to them.
You didn't? Did you talk to anybody, Sarah?
Only to be like, stop pushing me, please.
Okay. So there, because I don't know how much you caught of the mainstream coverage, any of you, Drew or anything, but I really saw very little notice at all of any protests. It seemed to be all focused what's going on inside the Fleet Center.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think there was very little coverage of the convention in general. I think, you know, and I think that's not really a news item for most networks. I don't know about if that was your experience being there on the ground.
Well, my experience being on the ground in almost any protest is that even if you do talk to them, and even if they do show coverage of a protest, that they're going to spin it some way that makes it sound like we're idiots or. Or sound like we don't know what we're doing. So I would much rather talk to independent media than to corporate media anytime.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think it's even worth it to talk to corporate media. They get their orders straight from the White House. There's no point.
I have a question here. Your perception of the Democratic Party or this ticket or how the party is going about its business right now, was it changed at all from your experience going to the convention? And I'll start with you, Sarah.
I'm sorry. Has my perception of the Democratic Party changed at all since my experience at the DNC protest?
Correct.
Is that your question?
Yeah.
No. To me, the front and center issues to this protest were police brutality and politicians who supported that, and then the ways in which people mobilize in the face of that. So to me, this was an issue of like what do we create? What do we do given these problems that we already knew exist? So rather than reveal anything new to me about the way the world works and the way, you know, like Democrats and Republicans, you know, still are supporting police officers who silence dissent. To me, it was more of less of an issue of sort of reanalyzing my ideas of the Democratic Party, and more an issue of just sort of trying to figure out what the hell to do about it.
Okay, and you, Adam?
Well, I went there not necessarily because I was upset at the Democratic Party, but because I was upset at the party system and you know, the way our government runs, or because we have a government. But after coming back from there, I went to the Republican National Convention in 2000, and once again I was just shocked at how much money these parties spend on these lavish parties, you know, champagne and wine and cheese and all that kind of stuff, and the amount of, you know, delegates that just sit there, you know, understanding maybe to some extent some of the issues that we're attacking or that we're proposing, and not doing anything about it except going on with, you know, their convention, which does absolutely nothing to, you know, better this country or better the world.
Just imagine what the $60 million or so they spent on security, if we could reappropriate that to some other programs.
Well, there was another protest that we went to. It was against a bioterrorism lab that they're setting up in a neighborhood, and, you know, they're talking about how, you know, all this money that was created, that's going to this bioterrorism lab, and for that matter, for the police presence that was there, could go towards improving the education system in the city and other services.
Well, Adam and Sarah, thank you so much for being willing to come on and talk with me today, and salute your passion, bravery to go out there this week, not knowing what you're going to expect when you get out there. And I'm looking forward to seeing your videotape, Sarah, when you get back here in Champaign-Urbana.
Thank you so much for letting me use your video camera.
you're very welcome. You see, you've now uncovered the great indie media conspiracy. The Media Geek loans out its video camera. All right, thanks again. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at a world of grassroots and independent media. And, of course, you can check us out on the web at www.mediageek.org, where you can listen to archive editions of the program. And I'll see if I can hunt down some of the video that Sarah posted, and I'll put some links up there. And I'll probably put them on your Band of Champagne Independent Media Center website as well, so we can all take a look at some of the footage that was shot by our own local journalists. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to get to some news headlines. Do stay tuned. Welcome back to Media Geek, and now it's time to take a look at some stories of our media environment that typically slip under the mainstream media radar. You don't even see them on TV, and they get stuffed into the back of the business pages in the newspaper as if the only thing which media was important to was business. It never shows up on a politics page. So here's a little bit of what's happened in the last week. On Wednesday, July 28th, the FCC announced that it will be examining the issue of violence on television and its impact on children. In this proceeding, the commission is soliciting public comment on questions like, how much violent programming is there and what are the trends? What are the effects of viewing violent programming on children and other segments of the population? And are there legal constraints on either Congress or the commission to regulate violent programming? The FCC will be accepting public comments for 2 months and then make a report to Congress. The commission also could consider expanding indecency rules to include violence, but may need congressional authority to do that. In a separate written statement, Democratic FCC Commissioner Michael Copps noted that the FCC's investigation of TV violence was prompted by a request made by several members of the House of Representatives. Copps also wrote, quote, wanton violence on the people's airwaves has gone unaddressed for too long. That is why Congress is moving on this on a number of fronts, end quote. A spokesman for the National Association of Broadcasters defended programmers, telling the AP that broadcast television is less violent than cable and satellite, and pointed to the V-chip, which allows parents to block specific programs based upon ratings for sex and violence. The FCC will accept comments on this issue through the electronic comment filing system on its website or by mail.
In other FCC news, four Republican senators, including lame duck Senator Peter Fitzgerald from Illinois, have refused to sign on to a letter to President Bush urging him to nominate FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein for a second term. Democrats on the Senate Commerce Committee will sign the letter and be joined by Committee Chairman John McCain, a Republican from Arizona, along with fellow Republican Senators Lott and Allen. The Republicans not signing are responding to the parliamentary maneuvers of Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, which prevented a vote on President Bush's nomination of Deborah Majoras to chair on the Federal Trade Commission. If Commissioner Adelstein is not renominated, he will lose his seat on the FCC when Congress adjourns. The seat must be filed by a Democrat, and in such cases, the President usually nominates the choice of congressional leaders of the opposing party. Commissioner Adelstein was formerly an aide for Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle, a Democrat of South Dakota, early last year. Senator Daschle urged the White House to give his protege another go-round at the agency. Adelstein was a vocal critic of the FCC's relaxed media ownership rules, which he voted against, and joined fellow Democratic Commissioner Michael Copps in attending unofficial public hearings on media ownership around the country when FCC Chair Michael Powell refused to hold more than one public hearing on the issue. And he hasn't shown up to the most recent public hearing I read about.
Mike, Adelstein?
No, Powell. Oh,
no, Powell, yeah, yes. Definitely, yeah. He was scheduled to be at the most recent hearing on localism and broadcast media held in Monterey, California, and he said he had a scheduling conflict, which is the second one of those. And, of course, that's interesting because this whole localism hearing is supposed to respond to people's concerns about, you know, how their local media treats their communities or how it serves their communities, although Michael Powell initially said, but this has nothing to do with ownership. We won't be talking about ownership, although because about, you know, 50% of the public comments, you know, that are made at these various hearings connect the two issues, it was pretty much impossible to keep that at bay, although most recently in Monterey, as we reported last week, they only allowed 400 people in. You know, and that's out of 23 million people in the entire state of California. So it's not so many. But the last note on Commissioner Adelstein is that his nomination, initial nomination to the FCC a couple of years ago, was held up for a very long time as well. Probably again, it was Republican retribution for holding up on federal judgeships, which the Democrats were trying to block, which Republicans were making. And so he's been a pawn in this game twice now. And Adelstein is relatively young for an FCC commissioner, but very well read, and you know, he's very progressive in his views, and has been a big supporter of low-power radio, big supporter of media democracy. And interestingly enough, he made a side comment to a friend of mine at the National Conference on Media Reform on licensed radio, because he was told that there was a station in Madison at the time that was broadcasting the entire proceedings live, and he said, more power to him.
That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media and our media environment. In the meantime, you can catch up with independent media news at the Media Geek website, www.mediageek.org. There you can also download and listen to the archive editions of the program in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format. Media Geek is produced live at the studios of Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.